In terms of the war on terror, who do you think should be the next country to invade?
Saudi Arabia.
Maybe somebody in the Middle East.
We'll make a big glass crater out of the fucking Middle East, for all I care.
I'm thinking Italy.
Italy?
Mm-hmm. Cuba.
Cuba?
Yeah.
Iran.
Iran? Why is that?
I think there's a revolution going on pretty soon.
Russia, China.
India, Uzbekistan.
Indonesia, Brazil.
Korea.
Korea?
Sure.
Yeah, why do you say that?
They're trouble.
They're trouble? Yep, okay. What's trouble about them?
Your attitude.
Hello, this is Chaos Radio, the International Edition, episode number 11. My name is Tim Pritlove. We haven't been posting many updates to this podcast recently, but this is about to change. And we are starting off with a recording of an interview I did at the DLD conference in Munich. This is hopefully the beginning of a new series of new international interviews here on this channel. We will see how this turns out, but for now I switch over to the interview. I'm very happy to be here with Stephen Levy. Do I pronounce this correctly?
Yes, it is.
Well, you're doing lots of things, and so maybe you just introduce yourself first, because I'm sure you could do this better than I do.
Well, I'm a writer. I've written about technology for over 20 years. My first book was called Hackers. It came out in 1984, and I've written 5 books since, and I work for Newsweek magazine now.
So this book you already mentioned, Hackers, and the tagline was Heroes of the Computer Revolution. Describe the hacker scene well, basically in 3 steps, 3 decades of evolution, beginning in the early days at MIT and then going over to the hardware hacking era of the 70s with Apple coming out with the Apple computers, and later on much more focusing on the gaming part in the 80s, if I summarize this correctly. So after all this time, I mean, when was the book published?
In 1984.
1984. So that's a long... long way. Do you think that the observations you did in that book are sort of still valid and hold some truth for today?
I was really lucky in writing that book to stumble upon that topic, which had not really been addressed at any length. And, you know, it's not just the beginnings of hacking that I write about, really the beginnings of computer culture. As I researched the book, it became clear that what happened at MIT in the late 1950s and early 1960s was something which had a huge long-term effect on the computer culture, and anyone who really comes in contact with computers and later the internet. And I think it's surprising that after the book came out, I think the things I wrote about became even more relevant with the internet and then later the open source movement. And it was just almost a happenstance that the last chapter of the book was about, the last section was about Richard Stallman, who was, you know, no one had ever written about him before. I sort of came across him just living in Tech Square at MIT. And, of course, he became a godfather of the open source movement. And between the internet and open source, he really kept the book current, and people were able to point to it for the lessons it had. It gave people in negotiating this world of sharing and openness, and while commercialism was also going on at the same time. So the observations I made about the hacker ethic turned out to be still valid, and apparently from the mail I get and people still talking about hackers, it's useful to a lot of people. So I'd say yes. You know, this is, you know, one book, you know, where a lot of the content is not dated at all.
There are many very, well, different but mainly negative connotations of the term hacker. What is your personal definition of a hacker?
Well, I think a hacker is someone whose zest for computing is unbounded and who proceeds really in a state, you know, that's rather pure, as a quest for knowledge, a desire to get your hands on things, to tinker, to manipulate the world. And computers offer the best opportunity for that because they're so malleable. So my definition of a hacker does not at all necessarily mean someone who does bad things, breaks into things. When I wrote the book, I had the freedom to really apply the term in that classic sense, because it really hadn't been associated yet as being synonymous with people who break into computers or steal or muck up other people's stuff. That happened a few years afterwards. And on one hand, that's unfortunate. On the other hand, you really can't control what happens to language. You know, and it just turned out that that term became applied to that. So right now, I think hacker, the word hacker, has multiple definitions. And one is that, you know, more positive force that I mentioned earlier. And I think it's also a secondary definition is, you know, a troublemaker, a thief, someone who manipulates computers and hacks into systems, not necessarily for good. So I think there's two definitions. The one I prefer and the one I certainly use in the book is that positive one of someone who positively shapes a world, maybe driven by a quest for knowledge and a quest for manipulation.
I had a recent talk with Whitfield Diffie, and he was following one of my lectures I was giving on the Chaos Computer Club, and I was also relating to the old MIT story and the Railroad Club. And he said, well, I left out one definition that the term hacking had back in the days, and he defined it as playing tricks on somebody. Have you been aware of this definition as well?
Definitely. I think that's included in there. There's an element of playfulness. And, you know, Witt, who actually is one of the key subjects of a later book I wrote, Crypto, and who was at MIT doing some of the artificial intelligence days, is certainly right on that. You know, the origin of the word hacker quite arguably comes from the way they use the word hack at MIT, which was a grand trick, a trick which involves some measure of, you know, cleverness and technical virtuosity, prank. So not something that ruined someone's life, but something which, you know, astounded people. Maybe required a little cleaning up afterwards. But something done in the spirit of, this is so awesome. And, right. You know, that certainly is included in it. Certainly I wrote about that sort of playfulness a lot in my book.
So do you think it's possible to regain this original definition of the term in media today?
I think, you know, I think both terms will get used. I think it's sort of a waste of time to start reclaiming a word. How can you get rid of a way someone uses a word? Language is like a river. You just can't change the river.
Right.
You know, so that the way it worked out is this river took a turn which maybe causes trouble for people who are classical hackers, but it's just a word, you know, get over it.
Yeah, I'm not really complaining. I just wanted to know how you see it from your media position as well. So when I read your book, I found it quite interesting that you had, well, you seem to have a very close connection to the people you were writing about. So, especially in the first chapter in the MIT Times, what was your direct involvement into the scene? Were you just an outstanding somebody standing outside of the scene and looking from far away, or have you been closer to these people?
Well, that's a flattering thing to say, because obviously the first part of the book took place well before I researched it. When I started writing the book, I hadn't originally even planned to cover that era. I thought I would start the book in Silicon Valley in mid-1970s, and then have a second section that's more contemporary with when I was writing it in the early 80s. But as I researched it, I began to realize, wait a minute, there's this really important story here, which actually sets the stage for what we know of as hacking and from the computer culture, and that was MIT back then. So my research led me to that. And then I started talking to those people and tried to win their trust so they would talk frankly to me. And they looked at me at first with suspicion because what they had was very special. And I was an outsider, a journalist, which isn't someone who typically gets it wrong. And I just wound up spending a lot of time with these people and attempted to reconstruct what happened back then. And it's interesting. In the first rev of the book, there were a few technical errors. I didn't show it to them before I wrote it. Which I realize now is a mistake, but I come out of a culture where you don't, in journalism, you don't show things to your subjects before you write it. So there were a few technical errors, but they all agreed that basically I got it right. I got the spirit right, and I knew this right away because the week the book came out, there was an event called the Hacker Conference, where many of the people in the book were invited, and then we gave a book to every person. The first thing they did was look in the index and see their own name and what happened to them. And you know, so it was gratifying in the sense they say, "Well, yeah, you sort of got that." And it's nice that you say that. I seem to have been close to those people because I spent a lot of time with them. But I'm not a hacker personally. I just wanted to understand what they did, and I admired what they did, and I hope that comes through in the book.
Oh yeah, definitely does. So you say you have been much closer to the scene in the second and third part, which also includes the time of the Homebrew Computer Club, which is sort of the first visible and named community of hackers of some sort. Have you been ever to one of these homebrew meetings?
I was there in time to come to some of the homebrew meetings. And then, but of course, in the early 1980s, it was not the same as it was the very first few meetings when people were talking about the Altair computer and someone showed up with one. And this is this thing that you controlled with these switches. You couldn't, you know, there was no input. There was no keyboard. What a keyboard. And originally it wasn't even an output. The only output was the little lights on it. And then, of course, people in the Homebrew Computer Club designed their own computers. There was the Apple, there was the Sol, there was a number of others. When I started going to the Homebrew Computer Club, it was, let's say, just around the time the IBM PC was coming out. There were new PCs coming out all the time. One of my main characters, Lee Felsenstein, designed the Osborne computer, the first portable computer. You would never think of it as a portable computer now. It's, you know, the size of a suitcase nuke, right? Actually, a suitcase nuke is probably more portable. It's called a luggable computer, it and it had a half-size screen that only covered the width of one line of text at a typical page there. So you had to sort of, you know, scroll vertically or horizontally as well as vertically. So, so it was a little different, but there was still a lot of what I was writing about in the early 70s, mid-70s, was still around in the early 80s. And, of course, the third part about the game hackers, which I was really more interested in the commercialization of hacking and how hacking stood up to all of a sudden there was money in this, which was a first in the 80s. I actually wound up living for a time with one of the game companies, and so I was able to cover that in real time.
Which was Micro...
That was called Sierra Online.
Ah, Sierra Online, right. Which produced one of the few very famous games in their time. Have you ever thought about making a second part, probably covering the two decades that followed?
You know, I'm asked a lot about what about a sequel for Hackers. And in my mind... I've written 6 books now, and I'd say of the five that followed Hackers, maybe 4 of them are arguably sequels to Hackers. In a couple of them, I literally returned to the scene of the crime, so to speak, back to Tech Square at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts. My book in crypto, I was back in that same building where the AI lab was, because that's where the RSA algorithm was invented. And in Artificial Life is another book I wrote. I was back on the 9th floor because I was talking about the robotics lab there. So that same spirit and inventiveness and creativeness and what drives that world and those people populate my writing in general. So in the most pedestrian sense, no, it's not a sequel following those people. Or I haven't written a book about crackers or malicious hackers or the chase for the hackers and things like that. There's been a lot of those books. They're all pretty much the same. But I think that I'm following the path that opened up by these creative people in a lot of my work subsequent.
Okay. So you already talked about Richard Stallman and the birth of the open source movement with the Free Software Foundation later on. Did you find this original spirit that you observed in the very first community, did you find this sort of continued in his work and what other people took on, probably with the Linux scene and other scenes?
Well, sure. The Stallman story is fascinating because his totally hardcore pursuit of free software was forged by his experiences in the AII lab. First, his experience in an atmosphere of sharing, which was sort of a paradise for him, in which he literally came of age in there. He was like a teenager who found a haven there. And then it all fell apart, and he saw the ugliness of commercialism when the lab was split by, you know, these different competing Lisp machine companies who wanted to commercialize software. That was a nightmare for him. It was like a child going through a divorce, and it left a deep scar to him. And I think that shaped, it helped harden his resolve. And, you know, made him, you know, extreme, I guess, you know, arguably in a very good sense, about free software. And those experiences, you know, the ones I wrote about in the book, were really, it's the rosebud, so to speak, of Richard Stallman. If you want to know why, for years and years, he had done such good work towards open source and free software, yeah, there's your answer. And again, luckily that also was in real time, because I met him when I returned to the AI lab, or when I was there. You know, he was going through this experience then in the early 80s, and you know, I sort of called him the last of the true hackers, which is sort of a joke, because he actually was one of the torchbearers in many generations of hackers to come.
So the scene you described in the hackers book is basically all based in the U.S., so it's a very American story, and with the coming of Linux, a European component was added in a way, of course, because Linus Torvalds was from Finland, and if you look at Europe today, especially in Germany, the Linux scene is very strong. The support is very strong, and it's also a very political movement in a way. Sometimes going hand in hand with the hacker scene, sometimes totally on its own. When did the European hacker perspective came into view for the first time?
I think it sort of evolved as the computers spread. And really, as people were connected more, that culture naturally spread. And one of the points I make in the book, really, is that this culture really springs from, you know, the act of a certain kind of person discovering the computer and acting out what's, you know, maybe not genetically there, but certainly, you know, behaving in a way that someone with, you know, the hacker DNA, so to speak, will act when he or she, normally he, has the opportunity to get in touch with the computer and manipulate the world in that way, and have fun in that way. Now, in Europe, what's a little different, I've noticed, is I saw the hacker impulse, from my point of view as a writer, as a political impulse. But very few people, very few hackers, you know, including the ones I wrote about, saw it as overtly political. There were exceptions. Lee Felsenstein, who I write about in the second section, saw that. But I thought it was a very political point of view. One which is, you know, very, you know, dependent on liberalization. It was a populist point of view, and it was one which is very anti-authoritarian. I find, by and large, there's more of a conscious political component in the European flavor of hackerism. They're more likely to, you think in political terms, to say what we're doing is political, as they do it.
So have you been following the development of the scene in America since then? So, I mean, there are a bunch of hacker style or hacker conferences all over the place. Have you been to any of these and felt the spirit there?
You know, I haven't followed it all that closely, but I have, you know, followed it somewhat. I've been to a couple of the hacker conferences. Hope is in New York City where I live. So I've dropped in on a couple of those. It's interesting because, you know, well, on one hand, a tenor of our conversation talks about the hacker that follows the definition of someone who breaks into systems and things like that. There's sort of an element there that does that in somewhat of a joyous sense, which is very prominent in these hacker conferences. And they focus a lot on the breaking into systems aspect of hacking, as opposed to the kind of hacking that someone like Steve Wozniak or Andy Hertzfeld would do. So even though Steve Wozniak maybe would speak at one of these conferences and be hailed as a hero, the rank and file of these people are sort of the 2600 crowd who exchange information on getting into systems, not necessarily maliciously, and maybe, you know, just to learn, but the line between that and causing trouble is sort of fuzzy. So in a way, it's understandable how the word becomes blurred, because as the years go on, I think the line between that sort of activity and a new, very malicious strain of dark side people has really come to prominence in a way which you wouldn't have imagined 20 years ago. It used to be very unusual for a quote hacker to be out in it for the money, to steal. You know, right. And for a surprisingly long time, there wasn't much of that. And now it's everywhere. And I think that a lot of the people who were, swiping credit card numbers and selling them on ICQ and IRC and things like that, in my observation, sort of consider themselves hackers and identify with that thing. And I think, you know, it's taking someone's credit card or identity and selling it, it is just antithetical to the kind of hackerism that I wrote about in the book. But there is sort of a blurriness over there, you know. Not to say that this is what chaos is doing, but there is a lot of people doing this, you know, and some of them are following scripts, but some of them are technologically adept.
Sure, and actively pursuing these
things. Yeah.
I mean, I think it's related that back in these times, the internet or any network or even any access to computer system was paradise. And, of course, reality was still very far away. Right now, we find the internet and reality going hand in hand in a way. So all the big trouble of the real world is now getting into this as well, causing a lot of temptation, especially for young hackers, to use their skills in a bad way. And that's definitely happening here and there, although I think that the hacker scene, the scene that itself sort of relates to the old times as well as the Chaos Computer Club is doing it actively, is still much more focused on this political vision that you just mentioned.
Right, and, you know, I mean, to me, a big part of hacking is just the wow part of it, you know. Hey, look what I could do. I did this. And whether it's just a really neat trick, something that causes delight, or, you know, even a prank, or something which is, you know, an amazing thing to do, right? Like Napster, right? Put aside the concept of infringement. What a great hack that was. I mean, to peer-to-peer. It's brilliant. I mean, it changed the world.
Right.
And I think in a very positive sense. Mm-hmm.
Yes, I would agree. So, the Chaos Computer Club is probably one of these groups in Europe that pretty actively took on this original political idea, and you, in this book Hackers, you put together these hacker ethics, or how you described it. Some people relate to it as rules, but I don't think that either you nor I would see it that way.
That's correct.
And I think it's a very interesting observation you did, because some of these things today are pretty obvious. Like, you can create art and beauty with a computer. Nobody would argue about this, although back in these days it was totally news, because computers were just used for whatever, but definitely not to create art. Although you could definitely call the first programs art in a way, like Space War and these things. Other things, I think, are still very true and still need some reflection in the general public. Things like providing access to the system for everybody, which is also a meme that the CCC holds up pretty high. In the European discussion, so especially in the discussion in Germany, on these hacker ethics and principles that are sort of associated with this, we came up with two extra sentences that we are usually adding to this. One is that you don't have to, you should not mess with other people's data, and the statement, use public data and protect private data, which much more focuses on this privacy scheme that is a strong discussion point in Europe all the time. Do you think this is also valid for the American scene, and how do you relate to these extensions in a way?
Well, I don't know. It's really interesting to hear this, you know, because as you mentioned before, those parts of the hacker ethic, which, you know, they're in boldface in the book, and, you know, I set them out there, were more in the sense of observations than they were rules. And these were something I thought, this is the core beliefs, whether they're articulated or not, of this kind of person, the genre. Hackers, true hackers. I wonder a little about your two other ones. I mean, how much are they just righteous ways to live, right? To add to that, and how much are they almost like the ingrained beliefs of people who are hackers? It sounds like it's almost like it, you know, it certainly makes sense. And, you know, as Bob Dylan said, to live outside the law, you must be honest. And your two extra, you know, ethicettes, what do we call them, seem to follow that. But if you go back to MIT there, a lot of these hardcore hackers just actually didn't believe in privacy at all. They felt that the privacy was not optimal. You shouldn't have passwords. And it's an interesting stance. And I think one that could be argued. I mean, you know, I could listen to an argument about privacy being overrated.
I mean, this works well in paradise.
What's privacy? I mean, you know, did I think the feeling I got from a lot of original hackers is it's a waste of time. It just slows things down. It puts up walls. It gums up the works. What do you need privacy for? What's the function of privacy? What's the point of privacy? What can you get with privacy? And it's sort of heretical, but I think I found people who thought that way. They hated locks. Locks, you know, and I'm not talking about what you put on a bagel. I mean, like, you know, the things that said, here's a door, you can't go in there. Here's a safe, you can't go in there. They were seen by a lot of the people as, you know, bad things. And people took locksmith courses just to learn to break them. And, you know, they were an affront.
Yeah, well, because these locks were keeping them away from knowledge and possible research. But I think today, as we are more and more depending on these networks, and it's not just something you can play with and learn with. There are some other aspects coming into the discussion, and one of them is definitely that the lives of the individual is the life of the individual is more and more sort of, well, at least influenced, if not controlled, by information that is available about him, and by pushing him into exposing more of his, well, whatever private data, properties or things he does, of course there is more to exploit. If you want to secure a system on the internet, I think we can't argue that this is a bad thing. Of course you have to secure your system on the internet. The same way you sort of secure yourself on the internet as well, because otherwise bad things can happen in many ways. The problem of identity stealing. People just like buying with your money.
Right. Well, that's huge.
That's definitely something.
As you say, it's a belief forged in paradise. You know, the reality of it, and particularly since the internet became what it was become, is that we're screwed. I mean, you know, we built the system based largely on these hacker beliefs of openness. That's the, you know, the philosophy behind the internet is no locks, open systems.
Sure.
And that's why, that's one big reason why we're screwed, because it's tough to develop an infrastructure that where is based on commerce, where this stuff is safe, and you know, so it's sad that humans are criminals, right? And that you know, there's a temptation to steal. I think the original hackers are the kind of people that if you left your wallet in the room, your money would be there.
Right.
If you had an interesting document with some secrets in it, they never would read it, but they wouldn't take your money.
Yeah, if they're true hackers, whatever that is. So, apart from Europe and the U.S. or the North American sphere, do you had any reactions on your book or general work or other books following the original one from other parts of the world that are somehow different?
Well, there's an interesting hacker community in Japan, for instance, and they take this stuff very seriously. And you know, I've actually been to some meetings in Japan. Of hackers. That's kind of interesting. I'd be curious to know what's happening in China, whether that movement is gaining traction.
What about Latin America?
I get a lot of mail from them. I've never been down there.
Okay. So, yeah, thanks for your thoughts. Anything you'd like to add, probably targeted towards the European hackathons?
I'm just super impressed that the chaos has been around for so long, and you know, and still is a presence. I mean, I heard about it a really long time ago. We were talking about the Hacker Bible, and I'm impressed that you guys have managed to stay vital all these years.
Yeah, it's an interesting development, and actually, I think that the movement is sort of getting stronger in these days as we are more and more confronted with the original problems. I mean, the CCC was founded in 1981. You wrote your book in 1984, and actually 1984 was probably the most important year for the CCC at all.
Because of my book?
No. Because
I was kidding.
It was maybe. I mean, it all adds up to this point somehow magically. 1984 was the year when we both started our own publication, Datenschleuder, and did the first Chaos Communication Congress. And of course, it was the icon of total surveillance by the book of George Orwell. Way. And since then, throughout the 80s, this paranoia was very strong, very very strong influence in how this the scene was shaped and was thinking of itself. So it was a very political movement from the beginning, and it was also a very diverse group, not only focusing on the technology as such, but getting people in from all kinds of society. So and that, in the 90s, when everything was like great and open source was winning and the internet was taking over and, you know, everything was fine, this sort of slowed down, but then got new dynamics when computers became so popular that every young one liked it, and then actually being a hacker was sort of cool for the very young ones. And now there's this backslash of this both globalization and the current global crisis in policy and this total paranoia and terrorism, where people sort of get back to the original values and rethink everything in this original context. So this was what was also very much under discussion at the last Chaos Communication Congress.
Well, to me, the hackers have won. I mean, this point of view has promulgated way beyond anyone's expectations. Certainly my feeling when I wrote the book. And I think it's been a terrific force. I think the hacker way of looking at things is everywhere. And I think people who aren't hackers, sort of somehow it gets communicated to them that there's this different way of looking at things. There's this creative way of breaking a logjam, seeing things differently, being creative, getting your hands on things, doing stuff, right? Which is very prominent in society. Whereas originally, you know, when I wrote the book, it was just this rather obscure, misunderstood subculture. Now, I think there's been a terrific triumph for the hackers. That through the medium of the computers and the internet, and kind of wed to, you know, their personalities being known and people, you know, understand about people like that and admire them, as you say. I think, you know, the essence, the good stuff of hackerism has really spread, and people sort of, you know, kind of get what it is to have an impulse to get your hands on things and change them and be able to do that. You know, blogging, say. You don't have to be a hacker to blog. It has nothing to do with hacking technically, but it's the same sort of impulse, right? Hack the media. Go ahead. So I think it's a great trial.
Okay, thank you very much, Stephen, for this small interview, and I was very glad to have the opportunity to talk to you.
Very enjoyable.
I hope we can welcome you to one of our conferences in the near future.
I'd love to be there.
And thanks again.
Okay.
Goodbye.